Everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Fundamentally Sound Podcast. This time is episode 49, and I am joined by a guy that I have read for years, not to date you at all, but my man, Gary Parrish. Gary, what's going on? I remember reading you at the Commercial Appeal while I was a student at Kentucky because it was the first coaching search and whether or not Calipari was leaving.
Right. I mean, yeah, that does date me a little bit. I remember when I could be the person who would say to other people, hey, I was reading you since I was a kid, or I was reading you when I was in college. And now to actually have those words repeated back at me is kind of that, combined with my bald spot, is a reminder that I'm a 40-year-old man now. But that's really nice. It was wild covering those Memphis teams. I was the full-time beat writer for 4 years before I went to CBS. And obviously, like, covering John Calipari is a beat in and of itself. Like, I would have people read me, not necessarily because they cared about Memphis basketball, but everybody cared about John Calipari. He was a big figure even back then. And I don't think it's an overstatement to suggest that if John Calipari is never the coach at Memphis, I don't know if I'm ever hired at CBS. In other words, the people who hired me, I don't mean to get too off track right from the start, but when I got hired at CBS, the other people who interviewed for the job were like from the New York Times, from the Washington Post.
Right.
You know, they worked at different places than I worked, but the bosses who hired me were aware of me, not because I was the Memphis beat writer at the Commercial, but because I wrote about John Calipari all the time, and they read about John Calipari all the time. And without, like, if a different coach is the coach at Memphis while I'm the beat writer, I might not have had the audience. You might not have read me back then. I might not have had an audience that I actually had, which obviously I think helped my career. So, yeah, those were fun times. I appreciate you saying that.
Yeah, and what was crazy even going back to those times is that was really – I felt like the birth of the mid-major, like the dominant mid-majors, because you had St. Joe's undefeated and, you know, right around that time frame. You had Gonzaga turning into Gonzaga. You had Memphis. You had, what, Louisville and Cincinnati were still Conference USA right around that time. So that was – just a crazy time looking back on it in college basketball, where it's only 12 years ago, but to think of mid-major, the quote mid-majors, being that dominant now, it's more like the Cinderella story now as opposed to that group back then of the A-10, the Conference USA, and everything like that. So even just the development of basketball in the 12 years has been interesting to see. And going along with that is, I want to ask you this, just a very open-ended question. What is the storyline for college basketball this year to you?
Trae Young. I think he's been statistically on another level than anything we've ever seen. It's well documented at this point. Nobody's ever led the country at the Division I level since assist became an actual stat in points per game and assists per game. He's obviously doing that. So just here comes Trae Young out of nowhere was the big story. And then it turned into, ooh, now Trae Young's shooting a little too much, turning it over too much, struggling a little bit. That became a big story. But I think certainly more than anything else, the story of college basketball this season has been Trae Young. He is certainly the guy I get asked about more often than anybody else.
Do you think it's
or anything else?
Oh, for sure. And I think going along with that, because I get asked this a lot too, and I go back and forth on it, do you think it's better for the sport towards the casual fans that he's at Oklahoma, a non-traditional blue blood, as opposed to the Kansases, the Kentuckys of the world? Do you think it's better that he stayed home and at Oklahoma and, you know, kind of turned them now into a top 10, top 15 type team while being the story of the year?
Perhaps, but I think he'd be the story of the year anywhere, although it's possible he would only be in a position to do this at Oklahoma.
Right.
Like, if he were playing at Duke right now, would he be doing what he's doing? Probably not. Like, you know, John Calipari, in between taking shots at Mike Krzyzewski about recruiting, actually complimented Lon Kruger recently when he was asked about Trae Young, because Kentucky recruited Trae pretty heavily. And it actually does sort of fall in line with what John said about Kay, because the point he was making in that press conference on Monday was, like, you know, he was clearly talking about Duke, but, like, we don't promise people that you're going to be taken care of forever. Like, we talk about you're going to go to the NBA. We talk about what we can actually do for you, not what, you know, not some fantasy land. And when he was talking about Oklahoma's recruitment of Trae Young, he said, you know, I give Lon Kruger a lot of credit. This is Cal talking. He said, when I sat down with Trae Young, I told him all of the same things that I tell most kids, which is, hey, you're going to come here. You're going to have an opportunity to play on the biggest stage, national television, sold out arena. You know, here's our track record of getting guys to the NBA. I talked to him about the normal stuff I talk to people about. He said, what Lon Kruger talked to Trae Young about was, we're going to run everything through you. You get the ball, everything is in your hands. You could score as much as you want. You can create as much as you want. And Cal smiled and saying, guess what? He wasn't lying.
Right.
In other words, like, sometimes, so. Yeah, sometimes guys lie when they say, hey, yeah, you're going to do it. Like, I always love it when coaches talk about, yeah, you know, we're going to play up tempo. Because, like, the numbers are the numbers. You can go look it up. They don't do – the coach – rarely does a coach who has no history of playing up-tempo actually, after saying he's going to do it, do it. I think one obvious exception to that is Steve Alford at UCLA last year. Like, he said we're going to play up and down, and they actually did get up and down, which was unusual for his history.
Takes a generational point guard to do that, too.
Well, that's exactly what it was, right? But Cal's point with Oklahoma's recruitment was, like, they told him that they were going to let him do what he's doing, and now they're letting him do it. I give him a lot of credit. And he even went so far as to say, I might not have recognized that. Like, I think Lon Kruger deserves some credit for recognizing Trae Young could do what Trae Young's doing, because I don't think many other people did. I know I didn't. I thought he'd be good. I didn't think he'd be anything close to this.
Do you think Kruger having Buddy Hield a couple years ago is helping with how he coaches – Trae Young, again, you know, Buddy was obviously a volume shooter, not necessarily as much the playmaker as Young, because he played more off ball, but having a guy that could just go get buckets and just say, hey, run your offense through here, get 20 shots a game, we're fine with that. Do you think Kruger having that experience already, it played a factor into Young being so good so early in the season too?
Perhaps. I certainly didn't think it hurts. And it's not just having dealt with Buddy Hield successfully recently, but also, like, that team was super successful. In other words, they have some evidence that we can let a guy just really take over for us on the offensive end and also go to a Final Four doing it. Like, it's not just, hey, we've got this guy, he's a unique scorer, so let's let him go do it. Like, we've been successful with not this exact blueprint, because they're playing differently and Trey's different than Buddy, as you pointed out. But they've been successful, and I think Lon deserves a lot of credit. He is probably one of the least talked about great coaches that we've ever had. I mean, he's a Hall of Fame caliber guy, and also, like, a true gentleman. Nobody ever says – you never hear people – you know how it is in this business. Like, everybody's talking about somebody.
Right.
But you never hear people talk negatively about Lon Kruger. I've literally never heard another coach say a single negative thing about Lon Kruger. He runs his program in a remarkably transparent way. Like, all of their practices are open, and I don't mean open to the media. Like, I mean open.
Like
if you're a dentist and you got the afternoon off and you want to go watch Oklahoma practice basketball, you can do that.
Yeah,
you can just walk in. Like, it's unheard of at the high major level. A lot of coaches have practices open for the media. When I was the Memphis beat writer, John Calipari's practices were open. I was in every practice for 4 years, basically. He'd close it every once in a while, but I was in basically every practice. But to have practices open to literally anybody, like, that is so not the way anybody does things anymore, and yet Lon does. It's just one other interesting thing, but more than anything, he's a terrific basketball coach, a great basketball mind, and to be able to, and I don't say this to point out his age, but it can be difficult for people to adjust to a changing game, to a changing recruiting world as they advance in age. And yet he's clearly had no problem adjusting. It's a great story what's happening in Oklahoma. Trae Young would be a great story anywhere, but I do think it's especially great that it's happening in Oklahoma.
Going along with that, Krzyzewski's a guy who, again, up in age for, you know, coaching, he's 70 and has completely changed his style in terms of recruiting and everything like that. How perfect is it talked about it earlier with Calipari's comments with earlier in the week. How great is it for college basketball that you kind of have this K-Cal, I don't want to call it a rivalry, but for lack of a better word, rivalry with the recruiting term, and then obviously Duke, Kentucky being two of the blue bloods, and typically in the top 10 year in and year out. Obviously this year Kentucky down, but is that the perfect kind of coaching rivalry for college basketball?
I think the best one we had was Calipari-Pitino.
Yeah, yeah.
you know, that because of all the history between those guys, they would usually say nice things publicly, but just trust me when I tell you, they do not like each other. So that was fun. You know, they worked in the same state as well. One guy had the job the other guy used to have. There's just a lot of stuff there, a lot of stuff that I thought, at least temporarily, like nobody tries to pretend Duke Carolina that there's a better rivalry than that, you know, in general terms. But I do think Patino Calipari at Kentucky Louisville made that temporarily a better rivalry, more interesting rivalry at least, than Carolina Duke.
Right.
But now to have Duke and Kentucky banging heads on they're recruiting all the same guys. And, you know, you said you hesitate to call it a rivalry. I can tell you this for certain. It's a rivalry among those staffs. Those staffs do not like each other.
Yeah.
And it makes sense. I mean, they're competing at the highest level of the sport for the best players year in and year out. And so they're going to be butting heads an awful lot. Kay won't really take it usually where John will. And John will usually say, this is his track record. He'll say something in a vague way, but everybody knows exactly what he's talking about. And then he'll come back and say, well, that's not what I was talking about. But even with this one, I don't even think he can go there. Like, it's so clearly what he was talking about. And, you know, Kay usually just sort of stays above it. Like,
right.
He doesn't get down there. He won't criticize John the way John will criticize him, either directly or in a subtle way. But still, I know the people who work on those staffs well enough to know that they are in a real competition, if not on the court annually, certainly away from the court every day of the year. And so it's been wild to watch, you know, Krzyzewski and that staff. I mean, let's just say it, be better at recruiting, at least in recent years. They are, for the third consecutive year, going to have the number one recruiting class in America. That's something that John Calipari used to have. Now, John's still fine. I think he's got three top 25 kids recruited, committed right now, but he doesn't have number one, number two, and number three. Like, nobody's ever done that. And so to watch a 70-year-old suddenly be better for a variety of reasons, like his staff is good and USA Basketball helped and blah, blah, blah. But to watch a 70-year-old suddenly be better at something than the guy who is widely regarded to be the best of all time at it has been interesting, for sure. And to just watch a 70-year-old run a program this way, this is what I was thinking about on Saturday night when Zion Williamson commits, is like, how many 70-year-olds can reasonably say that they are doing their job as well as they've ever done it? Like, I know Kay hasn't won a championship at the age of 70. I imagine it's coming, but he hasn't done it yet. So if you want to art, but I'm talking about, if we describe his job as running a college basketball program, preseason number one 2 years in a row, he's in the top five right now, about to have the third straight number one recruiting class in America, has literally put together a recruiting class right now that's never been put together in this way, having the top three players. How many 70-year-olds can say, I am doing my job as well as I've ever done it? Like, that's pretty rare. I don't mean coaches. I mean, like, people in general, history of the world.
Yeah,
like, it's
not,
a pretty –
there's not many.
There's not many. I mean, I came up with Clint Eastwood. Like, he won Best Director in his 70s, so he could at that moment say, I'm in my 70s and I'm doing my job as well as I've ever done it. Some other people throughout some other people, but the list is short and Kay's on it. And that's something that I find incredible, because you're not supposed to be doing what he's doing at this age. And it's why, you know, I don't know how long he's going to coach, but if he got up into his high 70s, it wouldn't surprise me at all.
No, he seems to be getting younger, which is great for college basketball and scary if you're not a Duke fan.
Right. Because I mean,
he seems to be getting younger and better, which I don't know how that works, but I want that secret.
Yeah. The way it's supposed to work is you get older, you lose energy, lose focus. Like, some 70-year-olds, I don't say this to be funny, but like, they just can't operate the way that they used to operate. Right. I mean, we all see people get older and age takes a toll on people's mind, people's physical well-being. And it's worth pointing out, he has had to miss games over the past couple of years for health reasons, but he is still doing his job as well as he's ever done it. And you're right, it's scary for college basketball, because obviously he's always been a giant, but he hasn't always been a giant who's recruited like this. They went through a phase at Duke where he wasn't able to get consistently people would beat him on recruits consistently. It's not happening anymore. I do think the staff deserves some credit. It's not all him, but and USA Basketball deserves some credit.
Yeah.
As well, his role there, that matters, even if he tries to discount it. But he's still the guy in charge of the program, And he's running it in an exceptional way.
You mentioned scary for college basketball, and I think one of the narratives this year is there's no one scary in college basketball. You know, years past you had, obviously, the Kentucky's the undefeated year, and Duke with kind of the same year who was in the top five, and Arizona's always been a top 10 team. And this year, the narrative has been, well, there are no great teams. There's some good teams, but no great teams, which I don't think is necessarily true as we record this. And, you know, and Villanova's at halftime right now, ending the first half on like a 25-4 run, something like that, against Providence. I think they're a great team. Do you think that that's an accurate statement, or do you think it's true that, you know, there are 4 to 5 really good teams and then, you know, maybe some good to average teams and everything like that? But is that narrative true this year?
I like the way you phrased it. I don't think there's one team that's just clearly better than everybody else. You know, sometimes we do have that. 2015 Kentucky, I know they didn't win the championship. They were clearly better than everybody else. I mean, that was the best team in the country. From start to finish, they just like lost a game you can't lose in a single elimination tournament.
And when you get a group of people to agree on something like every fan and writer did that year, it's clearly the best team in the country.
Right. So I like the way you put it. I don't subscribe to there's no great team. I think Villanova's great.
Yeah.
I mean, they're sitting here, as you mentioned, they're at halftime right now as we're recording. They're about to be 19-1 unless they blow a 9-point second half lead to Providence. I doubt that's going to happen at home. So they're about to be 19-1. Their only loss is a loss in which their opponent made 15 threes, shot 68% from 3-point range.
On a day that you're partner Matt Norlander talked about was a highly emotional day at Butler too.
Sure. So like you're at Hinkle, you know, number one teams have lost there before. Then they go out and shoot 68%. But here's the most interesting thing about that game. Butler plays out of his mind. 68% for three, 15 makes. 4 minutes ago, the game was tight.
Yeah.
Like the idea Villanova, here's how great Villanova is then. This is my point. They're so great that they were on the road against a quality team that made 15 3-pointers on them and still had a chance to win the game.
Yeah, like Jalen Brunson missing 2 free throws late in the game, the one guy you want there.
Right. I mean, so like most teams, if you tell me, I don't care who it is, whoever anybody else thinks the best team in the country is, you tell me, yeah, they're going into Hinkle. Butler's going to shoot 68% from three.
Yeah, well, you
lose it bad.
Right.
I mean, you get blown out. And though Villanova was on the verge of getting blown out, they were in a position to win the game late. So I think they're great. But the other thing you said was, is there a scary team out there? I don't think there's anybody that's scary. Yes. Villanova doesn't scare me. They're great. But you don't look at them and get scared the way you looked at Kentucky in 2015 and said, what are we supposed to do with this?
Do you think that's because of the NBA prospect where, there's Mikal Bridges and, you know, Jalen Brunson will probably play in the pros and DiVincenzo, you know, might play in the pros, but You think it's strictly the fact that, hey, there's, you know, a number one draft pick in Karl Anthony Towns and the number two draft pick and another lottery pick. That's the big difference?
Yes. What we usually equate to scary is pros.
Right.
Like oh, wow, they've got Karl Anthony Towns and Willie Cauley-Stein. And whatever you think about the Harrisons, they both ended up in the NBA. Tyler Ulis. Devin Booker, just pros everywhere.
Trey Lyles was a lottery.
Lyles. I mean, it is really, we don't have to get into this, but like, it's crazy that team didn't win the national championship. And I honestly think that if John could not have gotten through that whole season without the platoon, he needed to do it to keep all those people happy.
Right.
Like it was one of his great, I don't even say this in a bad way, but his great examples of manipulation to be able to keep all those players happy, because he immediately went from talking in a traditional way to talking about points per minute with his players. He would no longer talk about points per game because nobody was going to have points per game like other great players around the country, because they were all playing about 20 minutes a game. So he'd start talking about, wow, we focus on points per minute. Like so-and-so's leading the country in points per minute. And like those kids bought into it. He needed to do that for the season. If he'd have got away from it in the NCAA tournament and just said, you know what, Tyler Ulis is now my point guard. He's playing 34 minutes. Like, I don't care. Andrew Harrison, you can be unhappy for the last two games of the year, but Tyler Ulis is going to run this thing now. I think he wins the national championship. I think the platoon is the reason that they took that undefeated record to the Final Four, because he kept everybody happy.
And then lost it.
And then it is also the reason that they lost in the Final Four. But, like, that team was scary. 2012 Kentucky, scary.
Yep.
Like, what are you doing with those guys? I think 2010 Kentucky was scary. You know, DeMarcus Cousins, John Wall, Patrick Patterson. Maybe Duke in 2015, because you looked up and it was like Justin Winslow, lottery pick. Jalen Okafor hasn't been what anybody thought he was going to be, but
National
like
Player of the Year candidate.
Right. And then they had a super smooth, like first round draft pick point guard. Scary. When I look around the country right now, like Villanova's good, but they don't, you know, like Mikal Bridges is a lottery pick. Jalen Brunson may or may not. I think he will play in the NBA, but he's probably not a first round draft pick. Nobody else. They might have one first round draft pick on their team. And then you look, okay, the rest of the rankings. Virginia, number two. I'm not sure there's a first round draft pick on that team. Purdue, number three. I don't know if there's a first round draft pick on that team.
I don't know if there's an NBA player on those two teams.
Right.
Let alone first round pick.
Right. So you look at the top of the rankings, and those rosters aren't overwhelming, so they don't scare you. But it doesn't mean those teams aren't great. I think there's a lot of evidence right now to suggest Villanova's great. Purdue is great, even if they don't have rosters that scare you the way, you know, a great Kentucky roster might.
Going with that, how many – I think what people get lost into when they see how open, quote, open college basketball is this year with the no scary teams is they think, well, there's, you know, 30 teams that can win a national championship. And it's still, you still have to win six games in a row, which is incredibly hard to do. How many true national title contenders do you think there are?
It's never 30.
Right, right. But that's people. I'm saying more for the casual fan who sits there and goes, oh, well, you know, Louisville could win a national title, like, just because they see the name and they're you know, a 25 to 30 team right now and going, oh, they just have to win six. And it's like, well, that's still really, really hard to do.
No, you know what? There's a big difference between winning four and winning six.
Yep.
Like, I had a coach tell me, my Final Four coach tell me what this one time. He's like, there are about 30 teams every year that can make a Final Four. You know, South Carolina was a perfect example of that last season. I'm not sure South Carolina was really one of the 30 best teams in America, but you know, they got hot. They got to play home games basically, and then the bracket opened up for them, and they got there and they cut the nets, and they'll have that banner forever. I guess I should never say anybody will have a banner forever. It could come down at any moment, but
the
theoretically,
memories are there forever.
The memories are there forever. But here's what the coach said. He said the thing is that people don't there's such a big difference between going to a Final Four and winning a national championship, because to win a national championship, you got to get to the Final Four, and then you got to usually beat two excellent teams.
Right.
Like, that's hard to do. Like, if you luck into a Final Four, and by luck into, I mean you weren't supposed to get there, but you just – VCU Final Four teams.
I was just getting ready to say 2011.
I can't remember the exact stat, but I used to have it. Like, VCU in that regular season, I think made double-digit three-pointers in a game maybe once or twice. And then I think they did it three or four times in the NCAA tournament.
Right.
Like, that is lucking into a Final Four. They just got hot and started shooting at the ball in a way that they had not shot it all season long. And then they just shot it that way every game in the NCAA tournament until they lost. But so they were never going to win the national championship.
No,
like, once you get to the Final Four, you are typically dealing with, all right, we've got – so let's say somebody – if we all agree there's a handful of teams that can win it all, that means that – somebody lucking into the Final Four is going to be in that 20 to 30 range, 15 to 30 range. They're going to have to get to the Final Four and probably beat two teams better than them.
Right. You'll have to beat Duke and Michigan State or something like that.
You'll have to beat two teams that are better than you. So it's never 30 teams that can win a national championship. It's usually 7, 8, you know, somewhere in that range. And this year I would say it's probably about that. I think where it's wide open is it's wide open that almost – anybody in the top 25 making it to the Final Four wouldn't shock me.
Right.
But it would shock me if Nevada won a national championship.
Yeah.
You know,
I get asked about them all the time. It's kind of funny you said that, because I think they're really good. I think
they're
a top 20 team even right now. But, you know, like if they get to the Sweet 16, I'm not surprised. And if they go further than that, I would say, okay, that's a surprise.
Right. I mean, same thing like Clemson, you know, Clemson's a top 20 team right now. I'll be shocked if Clemson won a national championship.
Right.
Clemson can't win a national championship. Auburn, you know, Auburn's a top 20 team right now. Auburn's not winning a national championship. No. So it's not true that it's wide open, like 20 teams can win it. It's about six or seven, and it's probably Villanova, Purdue, Duke, Michigan State, Kansas probably belongs on the list still. Honestly, I don't know if you go much further than that.
I was going to say, I had a couple off the top of my head I wanted to go rapid fire with you to see if you would – if I said Xavier, Oklahoma, Arizona, one of those three.
Oh, Arizona. Yeah, Arizona needs to be on the list.
Okay, so then take Arizona. So if I say Florida, Xavier, Oklahoma, one of those three teams win the national championship.
I would probably lean toward Oklahoma if only – and I don't think Oklahoma's going to win a national championship. I do. I could see Oklahoma getting to the Final Four. But the cliche is defense wins championship, but that's not actually true when it comes to college basketball.
No.
Offense wins championships.
Yeah, outside of the Shabazz UConn team, right, every national championship KenPom team heading into the tournament has been top 22 offensively.
Right.
And right, like defensively, you just have to be top 40.
Right. You have to be good enough on defense, but you need to be really good on the offensive end of the court. And Oklahoma clearly is. And I guess what I'm saying, I don't think Oklahoma will win a national championship. Like, that's probably a safe assumption. Only one team wins it, and so it probably won't be them. But I could see, you know, Trey getting going like Kemba got going, yeah, like Shabazz got going. Like, that's not impossible to imagine, even if it is improbable.
Right, and he has enough help around him to where,
sure,
hey, you know, Doolittle gets hot for six games, or James gets hot for six games, something like that, or Manic, something along those lines. Last thing I want to get into you with is something that you hold near and dear to your heart, and that is the rankings. First, I have an idea. I do a blog every year of how I'd, quote, fix college basketball. Essentially, I become commissioner of college basketball, and what do I do to change it? And I want to run this by you and see your thoughts. And my thought is you get rid of the AP poll, and you make the committee, who you would then need to reconfigure from getting away from ADs, do the rankings like you do in football.
Fine with me. Like,
because they're the ones that are ultimately selecting who are the best, 36 teams?
Right. Right. Here's what I was. There's always going to be a number beside a name.
Yeah, it has to be.
There has to be. Honestly, for television purposes, it just sounds better when you say number one somebody is playing number seven somebody.
Right.
Most people do not follow the sport the way you follow the sport. And so they just go, oh, that team has a 14 beside its name. They must be pretty good.
Right.
You know, fans like to say the rankings don't matter, but there's literally no evidence that they actually believe that because as somebody who ranks teams every morning, they care. The page views are crazy and the insults are consistent. If you want to aggravate a diehard college basketball fan, rank their team just slightly lower than where they think it ought to be ranked. They'll come for your throat.
Even more fun, put their rival one ahead of them.
And so, like, I've been getting it from Purdue fans, like, basically all season. I'm like, I have you ranked fourth. You're actually ranked third. Like, are we really fighting over this? Like,
I have Purdue fifth. I didn't have him the preseason, and I'm pretty sure I'm not allowed in West Lafayette.
I know, right? It's just like, it's like, Parrish, your rankings are garbage. I'm like, because I have Purdue fourth instead of third? Like, right. Maybe it's just, like, wild. So there's always going to be a number beside the name. I don't care whether it's the AP voters who do it or anybody else. For television purposes, I don't believe you'll ever look at a game and not see numbers besides names. It's a way to promote the sport, and it brings people in. But I'm open to, like, who should actually be determining the rankings that are heavily used in newspapers, on websites, on television. I'm completely open to that because, as I point out every Monday afternoon with the Politex column, not all 65 AP voters actually have a good grasp for what they're doing, and that can often skew the AP poll in a way that's nonsensical.
Yeah, and that's what I agree. But going with the AP poll, looking at the preseason poll versus where we are now in week 12, is it kind of funny to look at how the preseason poll is done, and that's done mostly to predict who's going to be the 25 best teams in the country, whereas weeks one, not necessarily week one, but you know where we are now is, okay, well, what happened up through the first 16 games of the season, 18 games of the season? Is it something to look at going back to the preseason, going, okay, this is kind of playing out a little bit to what everyone thought?
It's always interesting because, you know, in this world where, I mean, we are content providers. That's what we do for a living. And so people like rankings. So you put them out as soon as you can. Literally the night of the national championship game, we project who we think's leaving, who we think's staying, and then we put a top 25 and one together. Right. And ESPN does it. Most people do it, right? I mean, it's just an easy page views grab. And immediately, lots of people, they say, this doesn't mean anything. Preseason rankings don't mean anything. And what you find out is that you could even go back to the night of the national championship game, and it's pretty close.
Yeah. Everyone had Michigan State. Everyone kind of had Arizona.
Yeah, I mean, Duke was up there. I mean, you know, you look at the preseason poll. Okay, so then you get closer to the season, and you get to the AP poll, the official AP poll, which, honestly, more now than ever, is really just a reflection of what we do in the offseason.
Right.
Like CBS does rankings, ESPN does rankings, everybody does rankings, and then the AP voters, like, look at that, and they put it in slightly different order, but – it does become a little bit of a copycat thing. But I don't even think that's the worst thing, because it's pretty accurate. Kim Pomeroy has done a study on this. The AP poll preseason is a pretty good way to forecast who's going to be good in college basketball. So I'm looking at the preseason poll right now.
Yep.
The top five, Duke, Michigan State, Arizona, Kansas, Kentucky. Out of those, four of them are still ranked. Kentucky just slipped out. But if Kentucky ended up back in the top 20, it wouldn't be the craziest thing in the world. Villanova in the top 10. They're number one now. Wichita State's taken some losses. They were seventh, but still a consensus top 20 team. Florida is leading the SEC right now. They were preseason number eight. North Carolina's in the top 20. They were preseason number nine. USC was preseason number 10. That's obviously not going to hell. They had roster problems, right? So you look at it. West Virginia was 11. Cincinnati was 12. Miami was 13. Notre Dame's had an injury. That's really probably the only reason they're not still in the top 25. Minnesota, clearly a mess, but yep. They've also had roster issues. Louisville lost Rick Pitino. What are you going to do? Xavier, Gonzaga were also in the top 20. They're still in the top 20. Northwestern has been the one, like, whoa, what happened there?
Right.
Purdue was in the preseason. Like, those are the best teams.
Yeah, it's pretty close.
We knew who they were going to be in October. We honestly knew who they were going to be in April. And it's why I roll my eyes a little bit when people say preseason rankings don't mean anything. I'm like, no, they are actually – there will be a surprise every year. Texas Tech, Oklahoma, Arizona State. And there'll be positive surprises, and then there'll be negative surprises like, you know, Minnesota, Northwestern, perhaps even UCLA to some degree. But by and large, like, if you want to know – Who's going to be the best teams in college basketball? That preseason AP poll is a pretty good place to look. It holds up surprisingly. It holds up fairly well every single year.
I'll let you get out of here with one last question, and that is, in all your time covering the sport, what's the most memorable game for you personally that you've covered?
You know what? It'll go back to when I was a beat writer. It's the Darius Washington missed free throws.
Oh, wow.
It happened right in front of me.
Oh, and what a heartbreaking thing to watch in person, too.
I've said this before. It is the most gut-wrenching non-injury sports moment I've ever witnessed. I didn't really like Darius Washington. I dealt with him every day. He wasn't like the those Memphis teams had some characters, most of whom were great to be around. Like, I know Christos Roberts is like living on another planet now, but he was awesome when he was there. Antonio Anderson was awesome. Joey Dorsey was awesome. Sean Williams, Andre Allen. Most of those guys I dealt with were like fun to deal, easy to deal with. Darius wasn't, for whatever reason. So I didn't love Darius. It didn't make me sick because, oh no, not Darius. It was like, oh no, not anybody. Like, my God, that is the loneliest sports moment I ever witnessed. I mean, he's standing there by himself. And you got to understand that season. I could write a book on that season. It started, they were like preseason top 20. They brought back, I think, four players from a team that, you know, made the NCAA tournament, four starters. And they basically, all they did was lose Antonio Burks and replace him with Darius Washington. Sean Banks was coming back for his sophomore year.
That's a name I haven't heard in forever.
He was supposed to be a lottery pick. Instead, he was a drug addict. But like, so that season gets off to a bad start. I think they were like 7-7, 14 games in. There was a split on the team. Like half the team like was in Sean Banks' corner. Those were like the gang members. And then the other half was with Darius Washington. And I can remember these moments from practice early when it was clear like this, they had real problems. Sean didn't even come back. If you go back to that summer, he got invited to USA Basketball, didn't go to the tryout, skipped it. It was at the Nets facility, literally like 5 minutes from his home.
Right, right.
He didn't go. And the reason I was told is because he was scared they were going to drug test him and he was going to fail the drug test.
Yeah, that happens.
So he just skipped it, all right? So then when all the other players come back for like second semester, summer session or whatever, he didn't come back. He got back to Memphis the night before classes started the next day, and he came back like skinnier than he was his freshman year when he was supposed to be putting on weight in the offseason. Didn't put on any weight. It was clear he had had a rough offseason.
Right.
And so then, and he had a different attitude, different everything. I can remember John like stopping practice one time and saying, "Hey, listen, I just want to make sure everybody here understands. I'm with the kid," pointing at Darius. "I'm with him. So if you're not with him, you're not with me. I know that we've got a divide on this team. Some of you over here with this knucklehead." He didn't use knucklehead. "Some of you over here with the kid. I'm with the kid. I don't want there to be any questions about where I am. I'm with the kid." Ultimately, Sean Banks flunks out of – oh, they go to Texas, lose. Arthur Barclay beats up Sean Banks in the locker room. Like beat – we could hear it. Sean comes out, big swollen eye.
Right. Put got two to and two together pretty quick.
Yeah, got to the airport. Sean Banks was refusing to get on the airplane, wasn't flying back with the team. He was trying to book his own flight back to New Jersey, just going to quit, fly home to New Jersey. Ends up coming home, flunks out of school. They actually – so they're terrible. They actually like start playing a little bit better, and they end up on a Saturday morning in their home arena playing for an opportunity. Like all that bad could just like that, automatic bid to the NCAA tournament. It's right there. Darius actually makes the first free throw. There's zeros on the clock. I mean, I'd never – it's
and that's the toughest free throw to make out of all three.
Oh, man. I mean, and you're just sitting there, and it's like, oh, wow, this crazy season is going to end up with Memphis back in the NCAA tournament. And the freshman point guard who had been ridiculed early and hated by some of his teammates is going to be the dude that puts him there. This is all like going through your head as this is happening right in front of me. And then he misses, and then he misses, and they lose by one, and he just collapses. Yep. And it was gut-wrenching because, I mean, that is – it's a lonely – thing. And it's one thing like if you just miss free throws to lose a game. That was you make it, you go to the tournament, you miss it, you don't. And he missed it, and John of course goes out there and picks him up. I always thought it was interesting because if you go back and watch it, Darius is so confident after he makes the first one, and then he like freaks out when he misses the second one. You can see like panic set in. And talking to John Calipari about this subsequently, he said what he wished he would have done in that moment was call a timeout.
Just calm him down.
Well, just bring him over.
Right.
And say, hey, listen, the whole country right now is calling me an idiot because they think I just froze you. All right? They think I'm freezing my own free throw shooter. So here's the deal. Go make the free throw. If you make it, we're going to overtime. If you miss it, it's on me. They're going to hate. They ain't going to blame you. They're going to blame me. All the pressure is now on me. Now go make the free throw. Huh. Just anything, because he said when he looked at Darius, he saw it.
Right.
Like there's – like John has said before, when we went to overtime against Kansas National Championship, we weren't winning that game. Like, it's just we're not winning the game. He said the same thing about Darius. I could see it. He wasn't making that free throw. And I always thought it was like should he have called the timeout just to say, hey, kid, calm down. I'm looking at you. I see what you're going through. This is wild, but we're fine. You know, obviously with the benefit of hindsight, you'd do anything than what you actually did because what you actually did didn't work. But yeah, that's probably the most memorable. I was there for Chalmers for the tie. I was, you know, Gordon Hayward's half court heave that barely missed championship game. That's a memory. I've been in a lot of them, but that Darius Washington moment was just, again, the most gut wrenching non injury sports moment I've ever witnessed.
I can't imagine. So that's a perfect story to end on. Gary, thanks again for coming on. If you're listening to this through my side, make sure you go. If you don't yet, I don't know why, because you are a college basketball fan, but make sure you rate, review, subscribe, and listen to Gary and Matt Norlander's podcast, Eye on College Basketball and CBS Sports. Gary, thanks a lot again, man.
Hey, thanks for having me. It was my pleasure.
All right, we'll see you.